Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest up today, James Galbraith, a professor of economics at the University of Texas, Austin, and author of Inequality and Instability. Before we get to that, just a couple of words on the April employment report. It was a disappointment. There was some thought that the slowdown that we saw in March after strong growth in January and February was an artifact of the warm weather we experienced during the winter. The thinking was that layoffs that might have happened in construction and other weather-sensitive areas didn't happen, and some spring hiring might have been brought forward as well, leading to some sort of payback in March. The hope then would be that there would be a bounce back in April. But April's report was saggy, with a gain of just 115,000 jobs, about half the long-term average, and the smallest gain since October. Almost 70% of the job gains came from bars and restaurants, temp firms, and retail, which do not seem the strongest foundations for long-term growth. Yes, the unemployment rate fell a tenth of a point to 8.1%, its lowest level in 3 years. But a major reason for that is that enormous numbers of people are dropping out of the labor force or never even bothering to enter. A definitional point. The labor force consists of the employed plus the officially unemployed. You have to be actively looking for work to count as unemployed. If you're not, then you're counted as not in the labor force. Of the increase in the adult population since the Great Recession began in December 2007, 95% have gone into the not in the labor force category. And the share of the adult population that's employed has continued to shrink throughout this so-called recovery and is now back to where it was in 1983. The economy and the job market are doing better than they were in 2009 for sure, but they're still quite sick. Back after a musical break to discuss inequality and instability with Jamie Galbraith. Some of OK No Way by Mission of Burma from 1982. 30 years. Don't tell me that God is dead. Don't tell me that Marx is dead. I don't feel too well myself, no. My only guest today is James Galbraith, widely known as Jamie. He's a professor of economics, holder of the Lloyd M. Benson Chair in Government Business Relations, to be precise, at the University of Texas, Austin. He was last in this show in July 2011 to discuss the collection of his father, John Kenneth Galbraith's works, published by the Library of America. Now he's here to discuss his own book, Inequality and Instability, a study in the world economy just before the Great Crisis, just out from Oxford University Press. Galbraith has been running an inequality research project for the better part of two decades at Texas, and this book is one of the fruits of that research. Before we hear the interview, just a point or two about his technique. Most economists who study income and poverty do so by looking at national surveys, such as the ones our Census Bureau does, and are drawn from asking people how much money they make and how. Economists who study this on an international level typically do so by putting together national surveys of that sort and massaging them into something like comparability. That's not what Galbraith does. That's why there's so much talk about technique at the beginning of the interview. Anyway, when I remarked about 5 or 10 minutes into the interview that there was no off-the-shelf data he could draw on, I was thinking about the lack of comparable survey data of this sort as a prod to get him to talk about what sort of data he does use. Instead, he contradicted me, pointing to figures on wages and such at the level of industrial sector that are available for many countries over the course of many years. I knew that. The point I was getting at was that these were never before used to measure income distribution. And I was further getting at a point, which I touch on later, that using average wages for industries or geographical regions may miss what's going on under the surface if the wage structures within those industries or geographical regions are themselves getting more unequal. I think this is a serious problem, and I'm not fully satisfied with his answer. For example, he claims that while work by the Economic Policy Institute, based on our annual census surveys, shows continuously rising inequality well past the point at which he claimed it leveled off around 2000, he says that that development was driven by unemployment and not increasing dispersions in wage structures over time. But the EPI data shows inequality increasing fairly steadily, even in times of falling unemployment. More on all this in the coming weeks and months. Also, on the question of why we should care about inequality, I was a bit surprised not to hear more distress at living in a society where some people have 5 houses and some are living in their cars, if they have cars. He says no such thing, preferring to talk about instability instead. James Galbraith. Welcome, James Galbraith. First of all, why should we care about inequality? Is it a moral issue, an economic issue? Why the concern?
Well, I think that the argument I make in the book is that inequality and economic instability are essentially the same phenomenon, and that we should care about them both because they lead to disaster. The economic inequality that we observed building up in the 1990s led to the crash of 2000. And the housing debacle occurred alongside a further rise in inequality. So these things are part and parcel of our larger economic troubles.
Now, you may have noticed that one of Mitt Romney's former partners at Bain is out with a book saying that inequality is good for all of us because it makes us all happier and richer in the long run. He's obviously not the first to make this argument, but what do you say to that sort of thing?
Well, it's certainly not surprising that someone with a private equity background would feel that way. And it's certainly true that during the credit expansions, the big bubbles that dominated U.S. economic experience in the 1990s and at the end of the 2000s, the bubbles themselves generated economic activity, generated employment. They reduced poverty in the 1990s substantially to some of the lowest levels on record. So the issue here is not that you can't have economic expansion fueled by credit. You obviously can, or at least you could under the conditions at that time. The issue is that it comes to an end in an abrupt and ugly way. And when that happens, people at the bottom of the scale get hit harder than anybody else. And of course, in the great debacle that happened after 2007, 2008, the entire middle class has lost a great deal of its financial security, a great deal of what it considered to be its accessible wealth, and faces a much more troublesome, in many ways unhappy future than would have been the case if that hadn't happened.
Now, the boom of the late 90s, the unemployment rate went briefly below 4% for the first time in a long time. How much did that very low unemployment rate contribute to the good times for all?
So the very low unemployment rate was a major symptom or fact of the good times, and as jobs became widely available, of course, people worked longer hours, they got more overtime, their wages went up, they upgraded their skills and moved up the job ladder much more rapidly. So all of these things actually produced the last period in the late 1990s was the last period where we had substantial shortage of labor, strong demand for labor, and a positive experience for people who were basically a large part of the working population.
This book is the product in large part of a group that you've been working with at the University of Texas, the Inequality Projects. Tell us about that and what you've been doing.
Well, it's a rolling cohorts of PhD students who have been working with me now since 1996. And the object of the group was to lay a much stronger foundation for analysis of the movement of inequality, and mainly not in the U.S., in the world economy at large. And we did that by accumulating data sets that could be turned into measurements of inequality. That turned out to be something that was quite easy to do. It's just nobody had done it before. That enabled us to, once we had those measures, we were able to take a look at them and to find patterns that I think cast a certain amount of new light on the phenomenon, the problem.
But there's not a whole, you had to put together some data sets, right? There's not a whole bunch of off-the-shelf things you can just look at.
Oh, yes. There were a great many off-the-shelf data sets at the international level and at the national level, which we could acquire for very low cost. I'm thinking, for example, a major example is the industrial statistics data set of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, or the regional statistics of Eurostat, national statistics for the U.S., but also for countries as diverse as Argentina or China or India. And in all of these sources, it's possible to construct, to use the information that's in that data to construct measures of inequality. And that's what we did. Our contribution here was not actually collecting new data from the source, but taking previously long-standing data sets that existed for administrative reasons or for national statistics gathering reasons, and show that they contained information which enables one to calculate very consistent and comparable measures of inequality through time.
These are not, though, constructed by census workers conducting surveys.
They're not sample surveys, no. They are, although manufacturing surveys are an important source, tax records are an important source, and various other administrative records. So in some cases, one is dealing with documents that are originally census records. In some cases, it's public pension agencies that collect this kind of information. But they're basically all publicly available in tabular form. And our insight was that you could use the category schemes and the differences between the various groups that are reported in the data to construct a pretty accurate picture of what's happening to the distribution at the broader population level. In other words, the groups are, when you have a sufficient number of groups that have a population divided up into a sufficient number of groups, what's going on between the groups is going to be pretty closely associated with what's going on in the population as a whole.
And a lot of what you do is based on data that's aggregated at industrial sector level or geographic level. What is the risk of then missing things going on below the surface within geographies or within sectors?
It depends on how finely your data are disaggregated and how many units you have. But so if you were working with 50 states plus the District of Columbia in the United States, you were going to miss a lot of things that are going on, particularly inside some of the larger states. If you're working with 3,150 counties in the United States, which is easy to do, you're going to miss much less of it because there's within a state like California, a great deal of the changes in income inequality are reflected in differences that can be seen between some of the poorer counties and, let's say, the counties of Silicon Valley in Northern California. So depending on how fine your group structure is, you pick up more precise measurements. What we found working with industrial data is that fairly coarse groupings capture most of the differences. If you have 30 or groups or so, that is going to pick up a very large share of the movement in inequality that you would pick up if you had, let's say, 200 or 300 groups.
And you would also argue, I think, that even if it might not perfectly state the situation at any given time, for making comparisons across time and space, they're very good measures.
Yeah, you're always making compromises in the business of measurement. If you go to a random sample survey, you may get the most representative picture of what's going on in the population at a given time. But those surveys are expensive, and the historical record of collected surveys in the past is very spotty. So for many countries, you will find that you may have two or three good surveys that were done over 30, 40, 50 years. And in between the dates when those surveys were taken, you really don't know what happened. So it's very hard to say you're able to say what events were really significant in affecting a change that you observed between, 1970 and 1995. Our approach, which is not based on sample surveys, but rather based on historical data records, enabled us in many cases to go and get an annual measurement, in some cases even a monthly measurement from many countries, and then you can track the movement of that measure over time, and that gives you a revealing picture of the specific history, when turning points occurred, how much proportional increase there was, whether there was in between these widely separated sample surveys, some maybe complicated developments that you need to understand. So that's, you know, there are different advantages to different approaches, but ours was one that had not been taken before, and it enabled us to fill in the record, and I think in a way it was quite revealing.
I'm speaking with James Galbraith, author of Inequality and Instability from Oxford University Press. Okay, let's talk more now about the subject directly. What generalization can you make about the evolution of inequality on a global level over the last 20 or 30 years?
Well, the first thing that emerges from our work is that there is a global pattern to the movement of inequality. There is a comprehensive global evolution of inequality. What we found was that if you start the data running in the early 1960s, it appears that the first 8 years or so up till 1971, things were relatively stable, some increases, some decreases. Then you have a period in which inequality in a preponderance of countries in the world is declining, and that is a period that comes to an end abruptly in 1980. In 1980, you have a turnaround, and there follows a 20-year enormous increase in inequality. And this is inequality measured inside countries around the world, so it's sort of the consistent global pattern across countries. The peak occurs in 2000. We see some decline into the early 2000s, and we're now working to bring that as close to the present as possible. So when you look at that pattern and you ask what can account for something that happens at the global level that follows this particular evolution, it's not mysterious. In 1971, which is the first turning point, that was the end of the fixed exchange rate Bretton Woods system, which provided a stabilizing framework for many countries. You then had a commodities boom and a debt boom in parts of the developing world. Period of relatively rapid growth comes to a crashing halt in 1980, and you have the debt crisis, which then cascades around the world. And you can actually look at the proportionate increases in inequality, and it tracks the countries hit by the debt crisis pretty closely. It's first Latin America and the parts of Africa that we can observe. It's later Central Europe and the Soviet Union, and finally in the 1990s, it's Asia. So you are looking at the cascading effect of financial instability and debt problems as they occur. And then in 2000, of course, that's the peak of the NASDAQ boom. Interest rates come down, commodity prices start to recover, and the picture appears to stabilize and improve. And we have data in particular countries, in the southern cone of Latin America, for example, where we can see declining inequality quite consistently through the 2000s.
At least one brand of economic theory would say that as we've reduced barriers to trade and the movement of people over the decades, that should tend to equalize incomes over time. It doesn't seem to have worked out that way. What happened?
I don't think that theory was ever seriously connected to the real world. It was the dominant neoclassical view, but that reality is that theory is a theory of international trade from related to separated industrial structures. And that's not what we've got. That's not what developed. What we have is an integrated global production system. And a implication of the traditional view was that you would see as a result of globalization and reduction of trade barriers, wages falling for unskilled workers in the so-called advanced countries in the northern countries, and rising in the southern countries. But that's not what we observe in the data. What we observe is that there are common patterns in the movement of inequality, by and large, across both sectors, both countries, both types of country. And that appears to be that the dominant force is not trade, but, as I say, finance.
And how does finance do that?
Fairly straightforwardly, when you look at some of the national data sets, you can see that the rise of inequality is very closely related to the share of income that is flowing to the financial sector. And this, in some countries, is quite enormous. It's astonishingly large in the data that we have for Brazil, for example. And then it peaks with the Brazilian crisis in the late 1990s, early 2000s, and starts to come down again. And as it does, the public sector in Brazil expands, and you have a reduction in inequality, for both because the public sector is more broadly based, has more people in it, and also because it's providing services which are being consumed by lower income people in Brazil.
Is the influence of finance just from the flow of income towards the top, or do finance people have an influence on the evolution of incomes below them? I'm thinking of, for example, the rise of shareholder power in Wall Street leading to pressure for higher profits, which means a wage squeeze, and also the pressure for austerity on governments coming through the bond markets. Is that an effect, or is it just the money flowing to the holders of financial instruments?
That's a more complicated question than we can observe in the kind of data that we have, although I'm sure that those effects are present as one lives in the real world and you can observe them directly in the newspapers or in the political process. I would say that in the United States, a boom period is always accompanied by growing incomes in New York and in the financial sector, so we're looking at Wall Street. And that's not surprising. Wall Street is the source of finance for all types of activity in a credit boom. Where the boom is actually occurring changes with time. In the 1990s, it was Northern California and around the city of Seattle were dominant. A number of other tech-oriented counties were extremely important. When you move to the late 2000s, then you're looking at the areas that were being pumped up in the housing, in the run-up to the housing debacle. And so you can see significant effects in Florida, for example, and in Southern California. So the secondary effects are felt in different places depending upon what is the credit bubble of the day. But the primary effect and the primary most significant income gainer in a credit boom is always the banker.
Your book has a lot of interesting material about the geography of inequality in the U.S. So you find just a handful of counties out of the more than 3,000 are responsible for the bulk of the increase in inequality over the decades. Tell us more about that.
Well, this is a very particular experiment for the late 1990s when you have an enormous run-up of inequality to a peak in 2000, then it comes down with the collapse of the NASDAQ. So the question was, since the measurement of inequality that we were using was based upon a measure taken between counties, how many counties were responsible for the great increase after, let's say, 1991 or 92? We did a little experiment. So supposing you take out the one county that contributes the most to the rise of inequality, and what we did was to say instead of that county, which is County of New York, State of New York, the one I think where you're sitting.
Actually, I'm across the river, but you're speaking of what's better known as Manhattan.
Better known as Manhattan. If we assume that that county enjoyed the average increase of income in the United States rather than what it actually did, what would have been the effect? And the answer is it's substantial, maybe a quarter or a third of the total increase in inequality, just that one county. If you take out four more, which are San Mateo, Santa Clara, and San Francisco in California, and King County, Washington, Seattle, then the total rise of inequality would come down by about half. And if you take out the top 15 counties, which is still just a very small number, then it all goes away. So what the tax data reveal is that the exceptional growth of incomes was very heavily concentrated in a handful of places.
And these places are also where the proverbial 1% live and work.
Of course. Well, the 0.1%, sure.
So does this have anything to do with, at least until very recently, the failure of inequality to take off as a political issue?
Oh, I think it probably does, yes, in the sense that we observe this phenomenon in national-level data, and there is a tendency to think, well, gee, this is pulling the society apart in every kind of way. But most people don't live in those particular places, and they don't encounter the people who do on a daily basis, maybe except when they turn on the television or read the magazines that cover celebrity comings and goings. And so this is not something that is a direct in-your-face phenomenon for most of the American public most of the time. And I think there is a tendency, at least in some parts of the political, the political discourse, to over-dramatize economic statistics and not to appreciate that what people are concerned about is rarely some number that's reported by an economist's calculation, including the inequality calculations that I might be making. But they're much more concerned about, let's say, the state of services, the quality of their schools, the safety of their neighborhoods, the value of their houses, and things which are affected by these problems, but are not where the connections are, you know, more remote, and the issues that they're facing them are really of a, you know, appear to most people to be quite of a different kind.
Now, you argue that the rise in inequality in the U.S. Essentially stopped around 2000, and not much of a rise in inequality since.
Well, what we see after 2000 is a sawtooth pattern. The inequality levels fell with the slump of the NASDAQ after 2001, then they rise again beginning in 2003 or so, and they come to a peak in 2007, and then they fall again with the slump in housing. And I assume that when the stock market recovered in 2009, 2010, that they rose again. We don't have the data on that yet. So what we're seeing here is that the inequality measures are very much dominated by the tax incomes reported by the very wealthy, and those incomes are very closely related to valuations in the capital markets. So what's happening with stocks and people who have positions that are related to stock market valuations. And what goes on in the rest of the society is, you know, it's certainly affected by that phenomenon, but it's not as volatile, not nearly as volatile, and so it doesn't, when you're looking at inequality as a measured concept, what's happening to the rest of the population is, in fact, exercises less influence over the numbers.
I'm speaking with James Galbraith, professor of economics at the University of Texas, and also author of Inequality and Instability from Oxford University Press. Work by the Economic Policy Institute shows that wage income has continued to become more unequal pretty steadily throughout the 2000s, but, you know, in a fairly steady pattern since the early 1980s. That's not exactly the story your data are telling. How do you reconcile the differences?
Okay, we have to distinguish between income inequality, which is basically income is a tax concept. It's what you report to the IRS as adjusted gross income, and wage inequality, which is coming from, can be measured in a number of different ways, but EPI's data, which I certainly don't dispute, come from a different set of sources than the ones that we've been using. This book does not deal with American wage inequality in that much detail. I did a book back in 1998 called Created Unequal that got into the weeds on that issue. And there's a time when there was an extensive debate over the role of technology and trade in these questions. My general impression is that when you're measuring the inequality of pay, a very important force on the measure of inequality is the unemployment rate. And so to the extent that the unemployment rate drifts up, and dramatically, of course, in the Great Crisis, so inequality in the pay structure is going to go up as well. Certainly in the data that we have for pay structures, although it's particularly in manufacturing, I think the generalizes to the broader pay structure reasonably well in the late 1990s, is that you have a considerable decline in inequality in that period. And again, that's because when you move to full employment, conditions at the low end of the labor market get better. And it's not surprising that they do. As I said before, you have people who are working more hours, they're getting overtime, but you also have employers who, because they cannot get all the workers they want, they start upgrading their jobs a little bit, and generally labor market conditions improve.
I want to step outside this country in a moment, but just one more question about U.S. inequality. A standard explanation for the rise in inequality in this country is that there are greater returns to education or special skills. That's accepted pretty much fairly widely across the political spectrum. What do you think of that argument?
I think it's an apologist's argument and one for which there is the evidence that supports it is being substantially misinterpreted, the so-called evidence that supports it. back in 1998, I took this argument apart, the notion that what was happening here was a demand for higher skills, and that people who were enjoying higher incomes was because they were more productive. At the time, the question was, how do you associate this with the technological revolution then ongoing with computerization? And the reality was that you couldn't. That as you looked at the diffusion of computers and information technologies, you found that they were, in fact, simplifying jobs and enabling jobs that previously had demanded a certain level of skill and responsibility to be filled by people who didn't need to have those skills and responsibilities, and so their wages were not improving. And what was in fact happening was that the very small numbers of people who were generating the technologies were enjoying enormous income gains. That's a very different matter. And the notion here that one can remedy inequality by supplying great numbers of people with, let's say, advanced skills in computer science is just completely belied by the evidence. We, in fact, did that, but the number of jobs in these sectors didn't increase very much, and it's a very tiny fraction of total employment. So you end up with a great many people who are graduated from institutions like mine, the University of Texas at Austin. We have a very big and very good computer science department, who find that the jobs that they hoped would exist are not being created in the sector and the numbers that would be required to employ them all. And that is very evident in the data. So I think that there was, kind of an apologist chorus that said, oh, it's technology, oh, it's education. And that the underlying message there was, don't worry about it, be happy. This is something which is happening for your own good. We'll all be better off in the long run. And the truth of the matter is, no, it wasn't being driven by technology as such. It was being driven by the credit cycle. And yes, this creates a period of boom in which people are better off, but when it comes to an end, you have a very ugly situation from which you do not easily recover, as we are learning.
We're listening to James Galbraith, an economist who teaches at the University of Texas and author of a new book, Inequality and Instability, from Oxford University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break for the second half of my interview with James Galbraith. Some of the second of five preludes by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy. And now here's part two of my interview with James Galbraith, author of Inequality and Instability, just out from Oxford University Press.
Cheerleaders for the American Way have been looking at the European crisis and saying that the European crisis is a result of excessive labor market rigidity, excessively generous welfare states, a lack of flexibility that we see here in the United States. What does your work tell you about that?
Well, that's also the view that was overwhelmingly dominant in Europe. Authorities constantly talking about the need for greater flexibility in the European labor markets. And so we looked at this quite carefully, and I just offer two basic observations. One is that when one looks at countries and even regions inside Europe, you find that those which have more egalitarian pay structures have systematically lower, not higher, rates of unemployment. So Norway, Denmark, much better employment experience than, let's say, Spain or Italy. And that is a very systematic association inside Europe that suggests if inequality in the wage structure is a pretty good measure for how much flexibility you have, and the whole point of the flexibility argument was that you should allow relative wages for the less skilled to fall so that they would be employed. The evidence just runs overwhelmingly against that effect, and you can make a very good, even neoclassical theoretical argument as to why that's the case and why that should be the case, why more egalitarian systems should in fact have better employment experiences. So that's certainly part of our argument. A second piece of the argument is the comparison between Europe and the United States, which is always brought into this. People making that comparison, I think, don't know very much about the United States. But they also almost always have compared U.S. inequality in pay structures with the inequality of any particular, some particular European country. Let's say, compare the U.S. to Germany, compare it to France, compare it to Spain, so on and so forth. And the problem with that is that the European economy is increasingly a single integrated phenomenon. And if you are an investor or multinational corporation, you can choose to locate a factory in Spain or in Germany as you wish. So we thought it was appropriate to try and measure European inequality at the continental level, including the inequalities that exist between national economies, between Germany and Poland or between Norway and Spain. And what we discovered when you do that is that the measures of European inequality go up by a lot. And in fact, the European economy considered that way is not more equal than the United States. Individual countries have strong social democratic traditions, although not everyone does. But when you take the whole European as a whole, Union as a whole, it doesn't. And it, you know, fundamentally has not gone through the federalizing experience that the United States has been going through since the 1930s, since the New Deal, which, by the way, has created a world that we all live in which the difference in average pay between where I live in Texas and where you are in New York is much smaller than it was 50 years ago, 70 years ago, much smaller.
You said that you can make a theoretical argument for the relationship between low unemployment rates and rather flat wage structures. Could you make it?
From a theoretical point of view, there are basically a couple of reasons why you would expect an egalitarian system to have a better employment experience. One is related to the way people look for jobs. In a very unequal system, you have a small number of really good jobs and a large number of really bad ones. Then a fair number of people are going to leave the bad jobs in order to line up for the good ones. This is a search phenomenon, a migration phenomenon, that's going to give you, as a result, a higher unemployment rate. The employers are going to be looking for qualified people near at hand, and they're going to make the justified assumption that the people who have left the farm or the backwater service industry, whatever it might be, to search for the higher paid jobs are more motivated than the people who stayed at home. So they're not, you know, there's good reasons why people do this. But on the other hand, they're going to spend a lot of time unemployed. So we see that. Second argument, which operates over a longer term, is that countries, and this is particularly true of smaller countries, but countries that have systematically reduced the differentials between the better and the worst paid employees, that policy puts pressure on the most backward businesses. You either upgrade so that you can become competitive, or you leave, or you close up. And over time, what happens is that higher productivity businesses migrate to places which have relatively egalitarian wage structures. And as I say, the more backward businesses migrate out. And so you can ask, why is it that Northern Europe, and Scandinavia in particular, which was an average, had incomes roughly the European average in the 1930s, how did they move up to be the some of the richest countries in the world? The answer to that is in part that they adopted a policy of insisting on high wages. And so the usual approach to this issue is to treat the wage as a market outcome. But in fact, in important cases, the wage is a policy, and setting it in a disciplined way has long-term effects on how efficiently organized and productive your economy is. And so it really is a question of having institutions, strong unions in particular, that can form alliances with the more advanced elements of the business sector and out-lobby, if you like, the more retrograde elements in the business sector. And that is something which, say, you can see definite examples of it in the way European industry has and European living standards have developed over the last 80 years.
It's also a fact that the countries that are deepest in crisis did not have particularly generous welfare states, and those that did have particularly generous welfare states are not in crisis.
That is entirely true. That is entirely true. One of the things that's very interesting, you look at our data across the whole world, there is a very clear gradient, and the countries with the lowest levels of inequality also have the most stable levels over long periods of time. And so that's, I think, another index of the institutional strength. But yes, what you see in Europe is the crisis is systematically in some of the least equal countries and has putting an enormous amount of stress, of course, on what are already quite weak social institutions.
I'm speaking with James Galbraith, author of Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the Great Crisis from Oxford University Press. You did some work looking at political structures and their relations to inequality and democracy, or the lack thereof, or the recency thereof. Tell us what you found.
Well, there are a couple of chapters in the book, one of them that looks at the world system and the other one that looks at the U.S. particularly. In the case of the world system, the question we asked was, does the type of government that a country has, is it associated systematically with the level of inequality that you observe in the country? And the answer to that is generally yes, in ways which are quite sensible. If you look at the formerly communist countries, communism was a very egalitarian discipline and it had the lowest levels of inequality. The countries that were more that were social democratic over long periods of time also had significantly lower levels of inequality, significantly more egalitarian than many other types of governments. Obviously, dictatorships, military dictatorships, this tends to be associated with higher levels of inequality. And we also found that when a country moves from a dictatorship to a democracy, this is not necessarily associated with movement toward equality. Of course, when the communist countries, when those regimes collapsed, inequality shot up enormously. When the military dictatorships in Latin America gave way to democracies, the progress toward declining inequality was very slow. Although, as time goes by and as democracies consolidate, we do find that in Brazil and Argentina and so forth, you have measurable declines in inequality over the last 10 or 12 years.
And the adjective social and social democracy is important. It's not just democracy, but social democracy that really seems to promote equality.
Yes, although admittedly what we're doing is using a label that is selected by the countries themselves, yes, but the countries which have described themselves as social democracies, it is associated with significantly lower levels of inequality.
And your work in the United States, you found some effects, relationships between inequality and politics. What were those?
Well, in the U.S., you have a very interesting data phenomenon, since you have election results that are tabulated by state, and the states, because of the Electoral College, are critical to the outcome of presidential elections. So it becomes possible and interesting to ask the question, is the inequality of incomes in a state associated with the way elections turn out? And then there are a couple of questions that one can ask there. One is it associated with how many people vote? And secondly, with the outcomes. And I wouldn't want to draw categorical conclusions about this, but it seemed to us, the evidence that we looked at did suggest that states which have more unequal income distributions have lower turnouts. You can interpret that in a number of different ways, but I think the common sense interpretation is that in states where the income inequality is very high, there's a history of suppressing votes by poor people, of making it difficult to register, making it difficult to vote. That's why we have the Voting Rights Act, after all. in terms of the election outcomes, the story is more complicated. And it is true that, and this is pretty well established in political science, something called the Gelman paradox, after Andrew Gelman, a very distinguished political scientist and statistician, that individuals who are wealthier tend to vote Republican, but states that are wealthier tend to vote Democratic. The question is, why is this true? And we offer a possible solution to this apparent paradox, which holds that in states where the rich and the poor are geographically a bit more separated from each other, the tendency of the rich to vote Republican is less strong. Putting this in concrete terms, you've got a lot of rich liberals in the urban centers of, let's say, New York State or Massachusetts or California, Connecticut, who live in separate political jurisdictions from many of their less wealthy co-citizens of the same state. And this is less true in the South, less true in the Plains. And when you do a measure of that, of what I call geographic stratification, it turns out to do a pretty good job of predicting how this pattern is going to play, and therefore predicting whether a state is going to go Democratic or Republican in a particular election.
Let's take a look at China. On a global level, you would think that the rise in Chinese average incomes, a very large portion of the world population, would tend to compress the global income distribution, yet inequality has increased within China. What do you find in China?
In our work, we do not try to measure the inequality of incomes across all persons in the globe. That's a different research strategy. It's one which has been executed very elegantly by Branko Milanovic at the World Bank. But it does involve placing a lot of weight on comparisons of average incomes across countries adjusted for purchasing power. And that's a very tricky business, which I chose to stay away from. What we are able to do is to look at the inequality within countries. And of course, what you find is exact. What you say is exactly right. Inside China, inequality has risen dramatically over the past 25 years, and that's, I think, an expected result of the process of urbanization in China. You have a very large, impoverished rural population. In the first wave of reforms, the average incomes of that rural population rose quite a lot because of improving agricultural productivity, but as people left the land and came to the cities, the gap between those who were in the cities and those who were left in the countryside went up by much more, very dramatically. You began to have some very wealthy cities in China, and we look at the data and you look at the Chinese government's own data, you can see that the contribution of just Shanghai and Beijing and also of Guangdong province in the south to overall inequality in China is dramatic. It's practically decisive. So those things emerge quite clearly in the kind of descriptive analysis that we give of the Chinese of Chinese developments.
And the case of China brings us to a classic theory in economics from Simon Kuznets, which is that in the early stages of industrialization, as people move from agriculture to the cities, inequality should increase. And then with further development, it should decline, producing an inverted U pattern that has proven not to be correct in some recent experience. So what's the status of the Kuznets curve and how have you amended it?
Well, my view is that our primary contribution is to reestablish the wisdom and insight of Simon Kuznets. You really can't beat him. He's a tremendously important figure, a tremendously powerful mind. And his basic insight on the movement of inequality over that inverted U is, I think, correct insight, which shows up in our data. It doesn't show up in a lot of other people's data, and we argue it's because their data is too noisy. But our data are really quite clean, and they give us a pretty good evidence that this pattern, in fact, exists, as Kuznets projected it would. At the same time, for countries which are amongst the richest countries in the world and exporting advanced technologies and financial services around the globe, it's reasonable to expect that you would go past that pattern of agriculture and industry. Industry, after all, can be divided into advanced capital goods and financial products and mass-produced consumer goods, and these are two quite distinct things. And so what we argue, and I think what we observe, is that for countries that are in that small category of suppliers of advanced products to the world economy, the Kuznets curve actually slopes up again. And so you get kind of a recumbent S shape in which, as the richest countries experience strong income growth, the real gainers in those countries are the people at the top of the income scale. Whereas for countries that are mainly producers of consumer goods, and, you know, traditional industrial products, strong growth means that wage levels rise and you have a kind of mass urban working class that benefits from that, and inequality declines.
A lot of people who look at increased inequality in this country and elsewhere to a lesser extent find that increased openness to trade increases inequality. What do you say to that?
Well, certainly our data are consistent with that for the United States. Insofar as the U.S. becomes more open to trade, what we're doing is exporting our airplanes and computer systems and communication systems, and, oil field equipment, financial products. These are very high-end products that where the incomes go to small numbers of very well-paid people, and we're importing automobiles and appliances and textiles and everything else, which are, you know, mass-produced consumer goods, where the incomes go to line working people. And the result of that is that you have, you're preserving the good jobs and losing the not so good jobs, and inequality is going to increase. And so I think it's entirely consistent with the idea that openness, increasing openness, is going to increase inequality in the U.S. case. Is this going to be generally true around the world? Not so sure. I think a country which is on the other end of that transaction, which is building up a manufacturing base as a result of producing consumer goods, you may see the opposite effect, and the overall impact on, you know, what happens in that country is going to depend upon that, and also on other things that are happening.
And finally, you argue that increased inequality leads to greater economic instability, that the crisis we've experienced over the last several years is the outcome of increased inequality. But the reaction, political reaction, to the crisis has not been a turn towards greater egalitarianism, but if anything, a turn towards austerity. What's up with that?
Well, I want to be careful about the phrase "leads to" or the causal claims. I think the safest way to express this is to say that inequality and instability are the same thing. One can talk about instability leading to inequality or inequality leading to instability, but the concept to grasp is that one is really a measure of the other. And what I do in the book is to present a lot of measures that I think demonstrate this to be the case. And that helps to move inequality, the study of inequality, from the domain where it has traditionally been stuck, microeconomics, the study of labor markets, into the study of overall economic performance. Now, you ask a question about how has it led to the austerity mania that we are now in. Well, I think it's a pretty straightforward, there's a pretty straightforward answer to that. I noticed that Lawrence Summers had an op-ed piece in the Financial Times a couple of days ago. I actually responded to it in a letter, in which he actually argues against austerity and in favor of growth. But then in the process of making that argument, says, yes, we need to cut entitlement benefits, raise retirement ages, and reduce sclerosis-inducing regulations. A traditional neoliberal response, or a little genuflection at the altar of neoliberal economics. And it's clear to me that what's going on there is a debate over who has to bear the burden of the collapse that has occurred. if I were writing in the Financial Times, I would say it is clear we need to downsize the financial sector. We need to retrain bankers or let them retrain themselves to something more socially useful. They can become home health care providers or something that we actually need. And that we need to use the resources which are presently being absorbed by the financial sector to deal with the problems that we actually have, from energy and climate change to the foreclosure crisis and employment and the problems of an aging population. And so this is a dispute over who has to bear the burden. And the austerity camp, particularly as it focuses somewhat obsessively on the very modest benefits that the aged population has through Social Security, or the insurance that it has for against health care disasters through Medicare, is simply trying to shift the cost from the financial sector onto a population that they consider to be politically vulnerable.
That was James Galbraith, author of Inequality and Instability, just out from Oxford University Press. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the Monk remix of You by Ellen Olien from her Dust collection. Till next week, bye.